When the Sabbath was over, Mary Magdalene, Mary the mother of James, and Salome bought spices so that they might go to anoint Jesus' body. Very early, on the first day of the week, just after sunrise, they were on their way to the tomb and they asked each other, "Who will roll the stone away from the entrance of the tomb?" But when they looked up, they saw that the stone, which was very large, had been rolled away. As they entered the tomb, they saw a young man dressed in a white robe sitting on the right side, and they were alarmed. "Don't be alarmed," he said. "You were looking for Jesus the Nazarene, who was crucified. He is risen. He's not here. See the place where they laid him? But go, tell his disciples and Peter, he is going ahead of you into Galilee. There you will see him, just as he told you." Trembling and bewildered, the women went out and fled from the tomb. They said nothing to anyone because they were afraid.
It does feel just a little bit sad this evening as we come to our last look at Mark's Gospel. It's been a really exciting journey as we've discovered who Jesus is through Mark's eyes and through Mark's testimony. We've come to know Mark's brief style and method, as well as his key teaching points. Mark has been very keen right from the get-go for us to see that Jesus is God's Son and the Christ. And in the first 8 chapters, Mark was introducing us to Jesus and forcing us to ask, who is he? Who is this man? And we see Jesus doing things that only God can do. And we're forced to conclude that Jesus must be God. And Mark shows us that the correct response to Jesus in the eyes of witnesses. And often they respond in great reverent fear to what Jesus is doing. The same way people did when they were faced with God in the Old Testament. They see Jesus doing the miraculous and they think to themselves, "Wait a moment, only God can do that. I'm in the presence of God." And this realization causes them to be amazed and to fear as they realize that they are in the presence of their Creator. They are in the presence of God's glory and holiness, and they realize that they fall far short of His glory and are unworthy to be in His presence. A good example is after Jesus calmed the storm. The disciples were afraid of the storm, but after Jesus calms the storm just by speaking, we're told that the disciples were terrified and asked each other, "Who is this? Who is this? Even the wind and the waves obey him." And the disciples were more afraid of Jesus seeing him do a God thing than they were of the actual storm. And Jesus can do God things because He is God. The theory is not that Jesus is malicious and they need to fear his wrath, but rather that he is holy and righteous, and they're not. And fear is the right response to God. It's us knowing our place before him. Later on in Mark's Gospel, Peter confesses that Jesus is God's King, and he joins James and John as Jesus is transfigured. And we see Jesus in all his heavenly glory. On that mountain, Peter is frightened. And he realizes that he is in the presence of God. Mark really wants us to get the idea that Jesus is God. And Mark has shown us as well that following King Jesus is not going to be a walk in the park. It's going to be really, really tough at times. Jesus describes it as carrying your cross. And as Jesus made his way to Jerusalem, Mark shows us that Jesus is the suffering king. The king who would die as a ransom for the many. And that the cross is not some random surprise event, but that it is according to the plan of God the Father. And obeyed to the full by Jesus, God the Son. Along the way, Mark asks us as his readers, "What about you? How are you going to respond to Jesus? Are you going to reject Jesus like the Jewish authorities and others? Or are you going to declare allegiance to him and follow him as your king? And recently we've seen what happened to Jesus on that Friday as he died on the cross and was buried in a tomb, as he dies in our place and pays our ransom. Mark wants us to see that Jesus really was dead and buried on that Friday, so he can set up for us what's coming on the Sunday. He was preparing us for glorious and miraculous news. News that Jesus is resurrected and alive by giving us evidence that he died. After all, Jesus could only truly rise from the dead if he really was dead. Last week, we finished with these words from S.M. Lockridge, and I'll read the last verse. It's Friday. The earth trembles. The sky grows dark. My King heals his spirit. It's Friday. Hope is lost. Death has won. Sin has conquered, and Satan's just laughing. It's Friday. Jesus is buried. A soldier stands guard, and a rock is rolled into place, but it's Friday. It is only Friday. Sunday. Sunday is coming. And this evening we're going to look at that Sunday, a Sunday that started out just like any other Sunday in the first century, the third day after that Friday. Sunday, the Sunday, the extraordinary Sunday. And before we take a look at these eight verses, I think it'll be good just to make a few observations. And here they are. The first thing is, I don't want to try and say more than what is actually in the passage this evening. Mark leaves a lot out that the other guys, other gospel writers speak about. We want to see what Mark is saying. And Mark's message is simple and straightforward, but also it's deeply encouraging and beautiful. It's meaningful. Mark keeps it beautifully simple because he wants to highlight his point. And the point is, we'll see that this extraordinary news that Jesus is raised to life is couched in the ordinary. The second thing is the strange ending in Mark's gospel. Take a look at verse 8. Trembling and bewildered, the woman went out and fled from the tomb. They said nothing to anyone because they were afraid. And as you can see, the gospel does appear to end on a bit of a strange note. It's very abrupt in the way that it ends. There's some debate as to why, which will make good discussion for afterwards, if you're keen to do that. But I think, as we understand what Mark is doing here, we'll see that it's a perfectly legitimate and actually quite a brilliant ending. And as the Bible is inspired by God, Mark ends the way God intends it to. Mark ends the way God wanted it to. And thirdly, you'll notice that after verse 8, there's probably a note in your Bible that says something like, the earliest manuscripts and some other ancient witnesses do not have Mark 16:9-20. And that's because it's been shown that verses 9 to 20 weren't part of Mark's original material, but rather added by a well-meaning scribe as he wrestled with the apparent strange ending in Mark 8. Again, this would be really good to discuss. We're not going to chase that rabbit, otherwise we'll go off track and miss the point of the passage this evening. That's our observations. Let's then have a look at Mark chapter 16, verse 1 to 8. And our first point, the extraordinary resurrection speaks for itself. A few weeks ago, Sir Paul McCartney was the special guest on James Corden's carpool karaoke for the London edition of the Late Show. Besides having the legendary Sir Paul McCartney in the car, the show was pretty much going according to plan, as per usual. Ordinary wouldn't probably be the right way to describe it, but it was just kind of par for the course. The comedian James is making all these silly jokes as the two guys are singing classic Beatles tunes. And as Sir Paul shows James some of the famous Beatles landmarks as they're driving around the streets of Liverpool, Paul shows James the house where they grew up and where he and John Lennon wrote many of the Beatles' songs. They visit the barber shop in Penny Lane, and they make a final stop at a local pub where the Beatles used to often play. And when they go into the pub with James, everything looks pretty normal. There's nothing particularly special about the location. It's just a pub in Liverpool. There's people chilling, eating, drinking, and chatting, and it's not very busy. And as James tells us, the atmosphere is actually pretty dead. A few customers are suspicious, though, as they recognize James Corden. Paul McCartney is nowhere to be seen at the moment. And so James asks to help out behind the bar. And then he asks a young lady ordering lemonade to go and liven up the mood a bit by choosing something on the jukebox. She goes over to the jukebox and makes a selection. And that's when the ordinary turns to the extraordinary. Because a massive red stage curtain swings open, whooshes open, and the music starts with loud gusto, and Sir Paul McCartney plays a surprise concert for those in the pub. I won't share what the opening song was, otherwise we'll all have Beatles tunes going through our head for the rest of the evening. But what was an ordinary lunch out at the pub became something extraordinary. I just love how the faces changed in the first picture to just at the pub with my mates, to, wow, that's Sir Paul McCartney. Everyone there knew and knows that the ordinary has changed to the extraordinary. This is special. This is something unique. And it's probably an event that many of those are not going to forget. And Paul McCartney didn't need any great fanfare because everyone easily recognized who he was. They recognized the extraordinary when he started playing. This is a great picture of what's going on in our passage this evening. Everything seems ordinary, but actually something extraordinary is going on. Mark just kind of matter-of-factly reports an extraordinary event. But Mark won't let us miss that the extraordinary is actually going on. Follow as we read about the woman's journey to the tomb in verse 1. Mark chapter 16, verse 1. When the Sabbath was over, Mary Magdalene, Mary the mother of James, and Salome bought spices so that they might go to anoint Jesus' body. Very early on the first day of the week, just after sunrise, they were on their way to the tomb, and they asked each other, "Who will roll the stone away from the entrance of the tomb?" So we have again the two Marys with Salome. These are the three women that witnessed Jesus' death and burial, and they're just about to witness his resurrection. Mark names them again so we don't fail to see that Jesus really was dead and buried. And Mark's kind of saying, if you lived at that time, or if we traveled back in time, we could have gone to Galilee, looked up where they lived, knocked on the door, and then asked these specific women if these events really happened. Knock, knock. Excuse me, did you, Mary, were you there? Did you see Jesus die? Did you see him raised to life again? Did you see where he was buried? Well, we don't need to waste our time going back in time because we have in God's word that it happened. So we can trust with any doubt that it did happen. The Sabbath ended on the Saturday evening, and the women go off to buy spices so they can anoint Jesus' body the following day. And the purpose of the spices wasn't like an Egyptian mummification, but they want to go and prevent the corpse from smelling badly. And then early on the Sunday morning, they go off to anoint Jesus' body. And notice that them going to anoint Jesus' body means that they weren't expecting him to be raised to life. Because if they had believed that he would be raised, then they wouldn't have bothered spending money on spices and anointing his body. A living body doesn't need anointing. Even their wondering who will move the large stone door reveals that they expect to find Jesus' corpse. As they arrive at the tomb, we have the second part of the narrative as they meet the angel. And as we read from verse 4, note Note the woman's response and then the angel's words. Follow from verse 4. But when the woman looked up, they saw that the stone, which was very large, had been rolled away. As they entered the tomb, they saw a young man dressed in a white robe, sitting on the right side, and they were alarmed. If it was just a young man sitting there, just an average guy, the woman wouldn't have been so alarmed. But they are alarmed, and Mark wants us to understand that the young man isn't just a man, but an angel, a messenger from God. The other Gospels say specifically that it was an angel that met them in the tomb. And they're alarmed because it is an angel. Angels are alarming. If you believe the nativity scenes with little kids dressed up in white with little halos and being all cute and fluffy as angels, that's the wrong picture. An angel is alarming. They are alarming because they represent the God who sent them. All the way through the Bible, angels appear in two ways. Either looking like and indistinguishable from a human being, like with Abraham, or like in this case, clearly a heavenly being. And the women react very appropriately to this God thing. They respond with fear. And the angel responds kindly to the alarm in verse 6. The angel says, "Don't be alarmed. You are looking for Jesus the Nazarene who was crucified. He has risen. He is not here. See the place where they laid him." Unless God sent the angel to the wrong tomb and the woman forgot where Jesus was buried, they're at the right tomb. The angel knows that they're looking for Jesus. And not just any Jesus, but Jesus the Nazarene who was crucified. And the angel says to them, "Look, you saw where Jesus' body was laid. You saw where Joseph laid his body. It's not here. Jesus has risen." I'm guessing most of us have experienced in some way the mistaken trouser identity. It's when a kid goes up to someone and grabs or hugs their leg and expecting it to be their parent, but it's not. And it's all the more amusing for any spectators when the trousers and the leg belong to someone totally unfamiliar to the child. Because the more unfamiliar the person, the greater the shock for the poor child. Tyron did that the other day, nearly walked out with a leg and the trousers that he thought was me. That was a bit scary. That's kind of like what's going on over here. The women are expecting to find a corpse, to find Jesus dead, but they meet an angel that's alive. And rightfully so, they are alarmed. They are terrified. And do you see how plain and ordinary Mark's retelling of this event is? We're told that Jesus is alive, and that's great, wonderful news. The story is about Jesus, but we don't even get to meet Jesus in this passage. The greatest miracle of all, Jesus raised to life, and he's not even there. The angel even says, "He is not here." And that's how we are to know that Jesus is alive. You see, here's the thing. Extraordinary doesn't really need an extraordinary announcement, because the extraordinary speaks for itself. We have to put in a football illustration, don't we? I'll tread very carefully. England are doing really well at this World Cup. They're doing very well. I've enjoyed watching their games. But the newspapers still feel the need to kind of big them up with punny headlines. I saw one this morning. It said, "Semi-gods." They haven't really done anything extraordinary yet. They're playing well, but they haven't really done anything extraordinary, hopefully, yet. Hopefully the extraordinary will come. Then it won't need any bigging up, will it? The headline can just say, "Champions." What more do you need to say than that? But for now, the headlines are saying "semi-gods," trying to big them up. The extraordinary speaks for itself. Think about how Jesus arrived on earth. Was there anything extraordinary surrounding his arrival? He arrives in a backwater town, Bethlehem. There are shepherds around. They're in a stable. Jesus' first manger, Jesus' first crib is a food trough. But the fact that God is with us, that's extraordinary. Think about Jesus' ministry in Galilee. He's avoiding crowds. He's telling demons not to say who he was. He's telling those he healed not to say anything. He's serving others, washing disciples' feet, hanging out with the lowly of society, choosing the dregs of society to be his disciples. It's very ordinary stuff that's going on there, but God's King among us, that's extraordinarily extraordinary. And his death on the cross, Mark just says it almost matter-of-factly. He just says, with a loud cry, Jesus breathed his last. He just tells us that Jesus was crucified. He doesn't say anything about Jesus being nailed to the cross. He doesn't give us any of the gory details or the agony that Jesus suffered on the cross. And he gives very little detail about what's going on around Jesus as he hung on the cross. Because the extraordinary speaks for itself. As we see Jesus on the cross, Mark doesn't need to big it up. Because we're to remember everything Mark has taught us so far about Jesus. This is God, the Son of God on the cross. That is extraordinary. And it's the same thing that's going on here at the resurrection. What more needs to be added to he has risen? What more can we add to that to make that any better? He has risen. He is not here. Jesus is alive. As Mark writes those words, he is risen. He wants us to recall everything we already know about Jesus, all the extraordinary things showing us who he is. He is risen. Three powerful words. But there are two more powerful words in this passage. Two more powerful words in this passage. And Peter. Because in them we see grace for those that stumble. The last time we saw Peter in Mark's Gospel was in chapter 14. He has a bit of a trick question. Do you know what Peter was doing the last time we saw him? Peter was weeping. Peter was bawling his eyes out. Mark 14, verse 72. If you're in the Blue Church Bibles, it's just on the opposite page. Mark 14:72. Immediately the cock crowed the second time. And then Peter remembered the word Jesus had spoken to him. Before the cock crows twice, you will disown me three times. And he broke down and wept. Peter's weeping because he's just gone and done the very thing he didn't want to do. He disowned Jesus. He's messed up. He's let the side down. We're back at the World Cup. Just aside, South Africa hasn't lost the game at this World Cup. It's been a very emotional, dramatic affair, hasn't it? Some of the games that are really close and they're going all the way to penalty shootouts. The guys have played 90 minutes, they've played an extra 30 minutes, and now the fate is decided on penalty kicks. And the guys I feel the most for, though, are the guys that miss their penalty shootout. They miss their penalty kick. And as a consequence, they send their team crashing out of the tournament. You can just see their devastation as they pull their jersey up over their face, over their heads, or they beat the ground crying in anguish. They've come so far and now they've let their side down. You see, Peter's let the side down big time. He's messed up. But so is his teammates, the rest of the disciples. They've all deserted Jesus. They've all scattered like sheep, like Jesus said they would. And we haven't heard about any of them since halfway through Mark 14. And it's in this context that the angel says these amazing words in verse 7. But go, tell his disciples and Peter, he is going ahead of you into Galilee. There you will see him, just as he told you. You see, the angel has a message for the disciples, and especially Peter. The message is, the plan is still on. Go and meet Jesus in Galilee, just as he told you. You're still on team. Jesus hasn't benched you. You haven't been relegated to the stands. Jesus wants you on the pitch. Get back in the game. We must remember that it's likely that Mark's gospel was written to persecuted Christians in Rome. Christians that were facing horrible persecution from the Roman authorities. And Mark is effectively saying to them, you may mess up. You may drop the ball, but you're not going to be dropped from the team. The first Roman readers, just like the disciples, just like Peter, and just like you and me, are covered by grace. I love those two words the angel speaks, and Peter. God's grace is sufficient for Peter. That's good news, because in Peter's worst moments, I can be a lot like Peter sometimes. I don't get things right. I disown Jesus by my actions and by my words. Like Peter on the lake, I don't trust Jesus enough. Like Peter in the garden, I'm more concerned about me than I am about Jesus. I'm more concerned about my way than his way. Like Peter, I say and do stupid things, sinful things. But Jesus has a message for Peter, and he has a message for me and for all of us. The message goes something like this: I am alive. I have risen from the dead just like I said I would. I have conquered sin and death. You, on the other hand, you have let sin walk all over you and you have succumbed to its allure. But my grace is sufficient for you. Come on, let's do this. And Jesus, the good shepherd, gathers his scattered sheep and says, meet me in Galilee. There are two extraordinary things going on in this passage. Two extraordinary things that are couched in the ordinary. One, Jesus is raised to life, victorious over death. And two, Peter receives grace, and we can expect that grace too. We must let these two truths encourage us, motivate us, and give us hope. Jesus has completed his work on earth and has set things up for his return. And verse ends with the woman afraid because they know they have seen God's glory. They have seen God's glory in the life and death of Jesus, but particularly in his rising from the dead.